Once again, we are back proceeding with the deliberations on the Isma Bill. Today we've got two documents in front of us. One is just the changes that have been made or amendments by us, and the other one is the actual bill with those changes factored in. I hope everybody's got the two copies. All were put on our tables. Without wasting any time, can we have apologies, Mr. Clerk?
Thank you, Chairperson. Just the following apologies: Honourable Smaller, Honourable Silao, and Honourable Ferguson. And then also an apology for non-attendance by the Director General of the Department of Energy, Chair. Those are the apologies, Chairperson. Thank you.
Thank you. Last week we went through the bill clause by clause and back up until the end, and we did ask the Department of State of Law Advisors to factor in all those changes. Now, if I remember well, just a small thing, one of the members, from time to time there were things that were outstanding, not necessarily responded to in full. And can we dispense with that? Can you make sure that everything, you know, that may have not been responded to in full by the advisors or the department, it dispenses so that when we handle now the bill once again, clause by clause, we know that we have even attended to two, three, or four of those outstanding issues. If there are any, you know, we need to be reminded, because we went back and forth in a number of things. So in that means I'll give it a chance to both the department and any of the advisors to make an input if there are still outstanding things which we had to address ourselves on. What about our minds? Over to you, Babungo.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you and greeting honourable members. We are sort of focusing on how we should handle it, given that we've got two documents in front of us. I would probably suggest, Chairperson, that we look at the actual bill that we sort of set in terms of the changes, but not necessarily do away with the A list. I think we need to refer to it from time to time, given the fact that the actual bill that's going to go to the printers is A list, not this document, the bill with track changes. This is just for ease reference. I just want to say a few things about this document, the bill. This is not the final bill that was printed by the printers. The actual bill is this one. This is just a skeleton that we sort of put together to show you where the changes are. And it doesn't have the numbering, for instance. You can't refer to it in terms of the numbers. If you look at the bill that we have been discussing all along, it got numbers on your right side in terms of clauses, in terms of lines, sorry. This one doesn't have, you know, the one that we track in the pages. So there's a difference in which you could refer to the two bills. For you, Chair, I will start, and then let's look at the A list. and I would also try and go back to. Actually, I think if we were to do justice, we might need to have three of them opened, because if you look at the A list that refers to numbering, which you will find it on this one, on the old bin that we've been discussing all along. On the one that we sort of crafted, doesn't have those line clauses, you know, which you will find on the A list. But the A list will say on page 3, line 37, for instance, if we read the first sentence. You will not find it on the bill that was segregated yesterday, the lines, because they're not there. So if you want to look at the lines, you might have to refer back to the original one that we were sort of talking about. It brings a bit of complications, but I think we would try and manage that.
When you say original one, what do you mean?
It's a gazetted one.
Oh, the original bill.
Yeah,
oh, okay.
Because from our drafting, we couldn't insert those numbers on this one. Okay. Then the other thing, Chair, we worked on the document over the weekend, and we sort of exchanged them with the sale advisors, but we never had the time to meet among ourselves just to, you know, find each other and fine-tune the documents to a state where we could say all the drafting and the issues are properly, you know, settled. But we tried our best to cover, you know, the issues that we could, you know, pick up, given the fact that we far apart, you know, in Cape Town or in Pretoria. I'm going to start from the right on top of the A list, which is the definition of ancillary services. I will try to refrain from referring to the clauses, to a line, because the line will bring complication, unless if we really need to, then we will have to refer back to the other bill. Then that will be your page 2 on your A list. And maybe before we go to page 2, the other thing that I must just pinpoint, on, if you look at the table of content on your bill, when I'm talking about the bill, I'm talking about the one that we circulated, not the gazette one. Within the table of content, I think that we should remove for purposes of printing, because we haven't removed some of the sections that we are supposed to remove from the table of content based on the discussions with the members. Then on page 2 on the A list, we need to read it together with page 6 on the bill. You will see that on number 1, we've got the definition of ancillary services there, which we are deleting, and we are also, okay, we are substituting, actually, I think that's the right way, with the definition that you will see on the bill. I think on the bill, it will sort of give you a view on how it's going to look like. Even though on the final one, you will not see the bold bracket information. That's just made for the members to realize or to know the section that we've changed. Maybe that's the other thing that Corona should explain from the beginning. Anything that we are removing or we are deleting, we put it in bracket bold. What we are setting is underlined. Okay, that's the definition of ancillary services. Then the second definition is dispatch, which is, it is on page 7 on the bill. That definition, we didn't change much from the, or the power, this is the new definition, if I may. Because if you remember, on the previous engagement we had with the committee, we agreed that we need to bring in the definition of dispatch into the bill because it was not defined.
Is it the same as in the Electricity Regulation Act?
Yeah, I think what's happening is that the reason why we decided to bring it here is because in the Electricity Regulation Act, as it stands, dispatch is not defined. But through the amendment,
sorry, the amendment. The man is a little bit forward because I've seen the amendment.
Yeah.
Okay, no.
Yeah.
Carry on.
So we thought it's important that we bring it here so that this bill stands on its own. It doesn't depend on the amendment that still needs to come. We define dispatch as means scheduling, coordination, management of flow of electricity produced by generation facilities or consumed by the demand side resource into and out of the transmission power system, including startup and shutdown of those facilities. It's a definition that is sort of aligned with the grid code. I think the grid code talks to this kind of definition. We thought it's proper that we sort of align those two. You know, the grid code is not law, but it's a document that is used, you know, to guide the sector. On page 3, on the A list, right on top, there's a definition there, expansion plan. And then you will find it on page 7. On the bill, we sort of inserted that. And then on page 3 again, the A list, there's a definition of integrated power system. We are actually substituting the current one, which is on the bill, with a new one. And it's flagged there. And then we move to the next definition, which is market operations. It's on page 3 on the A list, and it's on page 8 on the bill. It is underlined. And then the next definition is system operations. It's on page 9 on the bill, and it's on page 4 on the A. It's on page 3 on the A. This is one of the things we need to clean up. I think if you look at that definition, it says system operations, but on our A list we are saying system operations as well. But there was an agreement that we called it to use singular rather than, you know, plural. Called we need to check out that S from both sides. Then the next definition is transmitter, which is somewhere right at the end. I think if you look at the definition of transmitter, there's something that we omitted there. I think we are saying transmitter means the owner of the transmission power system. That end, I think we need to sort of bring it in. Because at the moment, if you look at the A, it doesn't talk about the end, and also, you know, we just flag it on the bill. So given that the bill will not be going to the printer, we need to amend the A list to include that end. Then on page 4 on the A list, we are omitting maintenance day. That you will find on page 11 on the bill. It's on page 11. Yeah, I think it's on page 10. Yeah, I went too far. It's on page 10. Yeah, but it's not highlighted. Yeah, it's on page 10, right on top there. We are sort of omitting maintenance. And on the sort of same page 10, we are sort of omitting electricity dispatch. this means electricity is decided to end. We are sort of omitting there. Then on page 11, on clause 4, we are inserting the, that is on clause 4.1b, we are inserting whose input must be to be considered by the transmitter. If you were to read the whole clause, it would say probably provide the necessary input for the development of the expansion plan by the transmitter in accordance with the anticipated electricity demand as per the integrated resource plan, whose input must be duly considered by the transmitter. That's how the clause would read after you inserted that section. Then the same clause 4, we are omitting expansion because 4.2. It will read in relation to the system operation is more mass, when you sort of omit that. And on the on section 2A, we are also omitting act as the system operator and, which means it will read in relation to system operation is more mass operate the integrated power system in a safe, secure and efficient and sustainable way. We move to page 12 on the bill.
Just start on that. Let's look at page 4 in the A list, under clause 4. I understand 1 and 2, but I'd like to get an explanation. One, why put in 3, which is in line 56, before 4, which is in line 46? If you take a look at the A list, it's just the order.
Yeah, I picked that one up, but I decided not to, you know, change it in last minute. It's the order. I think we need to put it that way around. It doesn't have any implications on the drafting, I suppose. Okay, then we continue to page 12. On page 12, we substitute schedules with rules. That will be your page 12. On the page 4.2f. Then on page even this one, I think it's the same thing that you raised here. It needs to be other way around in terms of the lines 3 and 4. That is 56 and 46. Then we are on page 12. If we were to follow the order as in the bill, we start with the end on hop day. Okay, maybe not. Okay, let's follow at the A so that we don't get confused. On page 13, we are substituting system operator with system operations. Okay, system operations. And there is an end there that I could pick up on my bill that is sort of omitted.
Which page?
I think it's on page 18. Yeah. On S. I think it's on 4.2S.
What are you doing in 4.2S?
On 2, yeah. 4.2S. We are removing that end.
Okay.
On S. Okay. I think it's not on the A.
It's there. Five in A.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I think it's supposed to go up.
Okay. Get on.
For the number. Then we dealt with 5, and then on page, okay, I'm referring to page, so you go back. Then on page 13 again, on the bill, on line, not line, I think it's 42U. It's a new U that we are sort of inserting, which will read as, I think we need to read it with the thing about losing funds. We need to compare it with the first.
But my understanding, before you go in there, according to page 4 in the A list, you insert the end now,
yeah,
which you remove from, according to pieces,
yes,
you remove from S, you put it,
yes,
at T,
yes,
because you've got an additional,
yes,
last subclause.
Yes, sir.
Okay, go for it.
Yes, we are inserting that. Because we moved, it's just that the order was not sort of okay. Then we are inserting that on page 13. We are inserting order to interruption of supply to preserve system integrity in times of power shortage. Then on 3, I think that would be your 4-3. On the bill, on the A list, it should be on page 5 rather than top. It will be on page 5 or top. What we are doing there, we are replacing as market operator with in relation to market operation. Which means if you were to read the bill, it will say in relation to market operation is more must buy electricity from generator or external trader in line with government policy. And then we move to same page 5 on the A list. We are deleting D there, we're sort of substituting it with a new section. You'll see that the deleted section is in brackets and the new section is underlined. And then the new section would read as that this will be our new D. Procure electricity on such terms and conditions as may be agreed upon by parties from licenses with exception of generation licenses is exempted from selling to ISMO in terms of the Electricity Regulation Act, who consists, agreed upon parties consistent with the integrated resource plan in terms of the procurement process contained in the Electricity Regulation Act. We, if you notice, we have removed, without repeating what we discussed previously, we have removed the Republic and outside of the borders, you know, as one of the things that there was a issue about subjecting that to similar conditions.
Are you done?
Then on page 14.
Wait, before you move. If you look at the A list, you say with the in D1, in Roman 1, you say from licensees with the exception of licensees. Exempted from, but to say in the here in the this new bill, from licenses with the exception of generation licenses. What can we remember? Remember, we said to retain or remove generation licenses. Now you guys, because you guys are confusing us. On one document, you include generation, and the other one, you exclude. What are you proposing? Tell me.
I think we need to remove generation there.
Okay.
And leave licenses. because the thinking was that some of the licenses might not be generators. It could be a trader, for instance. So if you say generation, you sort of restrict it to only generation. You exclude traders. And then if you just go almost towards the end of the same page, which on edge, we sort of write the megawatt in full day. We delete MW, which is megawatt, then we write in full. Yeah, I understand that's how it's supposed to be.
Apologies, I was just saying a megawatt, the M must be capital letters, the W must be capital letters.
Yes, Mr. Engineer.
Thank you, Chair. And then we move to page 15. We are on page 15, I think it's number 4. We are inserting a new section there, which will read, ISMO may, with the concurrence of the minister, perform such other functions as may be necessary to give effect to or ancillary service or ancillary to its function as set out in subsection 1 and 2, 3. This was a sort of catch-all clause that was inserted. And then, Chair, on clause, on the bill, it's clause 6. It's clause 6. I see we put in the numbering. It's clause 6, which deals with subsidiaries. We have rejected the whole of that clause. And then on clause 11, I think we move all the way from clause 6 to clause 11. Clause 11, we are on page 6 on the A list. We removing the minister, clause 11.1, just after the chairperson day, the sort of, yeah, it's page 20 on the bill, page 6 on the A list. We are removing the minister. We are replacing the minister with the board. Page 20 on the bill. Members will remember that this was the argument that we need to have the board to appoint the acting chairperson in case the deputy chairperson and the chairperson is not available. Then we move to clause 13. Appointment of non-executive members of the board. Right on top of clause 18, we are deleting the first 13.1. We are actually replacing it with a new section. I see there's a note here that 11 is actually not correct in reference to the original bill, the gazetted bill. I think that 11 is supposed to be 9. I think it's line 9, not line 11. If you were to read, it will read, if you were to read the A list, it will read on page 9 from line 9 to omit subclause 1. That's how we should read, I think. Cross check. And then they would, or my colleague would also try and confirm that. And then If I were to read the section that we are inserting there, it will read, for the purpose of appointing the non-executive members, the minister must, by notice, in at least 2 newspapers and in the Gazette, invite interested parties to submit or invite interested person to submit or interested parties to nominate candidate within the period and in a manner mentioned in the notice. I think what we have done, we have reworked that section to include interested parties to nominate candidates in line with the resolution made by members. The previous section did not take into account parties, it sort of focused only on persons. If we continue, still on page 6 on the A list, page 6, number 2, that you will find it on page 21, 13.3A, we are omitting geographic areas of the Republic. Because there was an issue about that you can't require the voice to be geographically represented. And then, just the last clause on page 21 on the bill, which is still on page 6 on the A list, we are omitting the minister and, meaning that it will read, to ensure that committee members have the necessary skills, knowledge, qualification, and experience to serve on the committee. Okay, that's it. Okay. Then the section underneath will say the nomination committee, in making recommendations to the minister, must consider the following. And then on page 9, okay, I said I'm not going to refer to page. Still on page 6 on the A list. On the bill, it's page 22, right at the end there, we are deleting 8 there, and we substitute it with a new paragraph, which will read, any vacancy occurring in board in terms of section 14 must be filled in a manner provided for in this section within 6 months of such vacancy occurring. Yeah. We added the 6 months day, which was not the on the previous section. Then we move to clause 15, which is on page 25 on the bill. Right on top of page 25, which is 15.1, we are replacing may with must in line with the resolution by members, and we made minor changes there. I think Chair was asking whether it's the tennis court or what, so we added court of law.
I thought we were still interested in declaring everything in a balance court.
Then on clause 17, it was on page 28, right on top of 28 on the bill, it's the whole issue about the quorum. We are replacing that, the 50%, the 70% with 50% plus one. And then if you go further, a little bit further down on committee of board, which is clause 18 on the bill, same page 28, we are taking away the concurrency there by the minister, which means the section will read now, the board may appoint one or more committees, but must appoint the following committees. This means they don't need the concurrence of the minister to appoint those boards. We are then moving away, deleting the end, and then putting it on 4C so that it's sort of aligned with the new insertion that is made. Then lastly, on that section, we then omit subsection 4, which is 18.4, subsection 4. We are omitting that in line with the resolution taken. And then we move to 19. On clause 19.
That's all. Back to that clause about the committees, remuneration, human resource and audit. But then some reference somewhere the audit committee visited Sunday, I think something that has to be
appointed by shareholder.
And that, I think it's a degree of power and that I'm comfortable without linking that whatever that was.
It's an issue that I think I raised at some point, that if you look at the King 3 report, it sort of talks about the audit committee being appointed by shareholders. And then it reports to both the shareholders and the board. But I sort of flag that point for members to consider, to think about, but it wasn't a resolution.
Prof, okay.
Yes, thinking a lot, I'm more comfortable with the arrangement as it is, because when you refer to this one, when you say shareholder, unless we take the government on its own, it's going to do that. I'm saying if you to take that key in context, I don't think it's going to apply here. And they let us allow the shareholder to appoint the audit committee. And let would say now, minister, go in a corner as a shareholder and do this. With that understanding, I'm comfortable putting it here consciously as it is, not taking it to the shareholder.
Okay, can I provoke response from other members? Maybe as they are thinking, if you could just get the advisor to comment as well. Where we are, Advocate Vanara and Advocate Migiso, is the appointment of an audit committee. According to King 3, supposed to be appointed by the shareholder. But here, we are saying it should be appointed by the board itself. So,
again, if I take it to universities and council, the audit committees there, despite the King 3, are appointed by the council.
Itself.
So using that, to me, I'm comfortable with living the situation.
Honorable Lotto?
Chairperson, I personally believe it might not do any harm even if you leave it as it is and there be a common pact, agreed upon practice between the board and the minister, that the minister doesn't have a point, can say I approve the recommendation of, without putting it in writing here, the minister can say I approve the recommendation that you have of the audit committee, and I approve at the AGM, say I approve the recommendation that you have of the audit committee, approve the external auditor that you recommend for appointment without stating it, unless they're going to be verified. But I would assume that the Companies Act would then prevail, the provisions of the Companies Act would then prevail in that instance.
Advocate Vanara.
Chair, can we as the lawyers be given some indulgence without necessarily holding back the committee's deliberation. Can we so long be looking at the issue and give that to the committee?
That's fine, Honorable Failing.
No, I wasn't really going to say anything. I mean, I just was, what was a bit confusing to me was, does this audit committee have to be a separate committee from the board? Because if it's appointed by the shareholder, is it, does it comprise of the board, or is it another committee that gets set up independently? But I suppose we will wait on the lawyer's opinion as to how this works. Fine.
Thank you. Let's proceed then for now.
Thank you, Chair. We're on clause 18. Oh, we dealt with 4, the division of that. And then we're on 9, we dealt with 19 as well. We didn't deal with 19?
No.
Okay. Yeah, on 19 we're sort of deleting the whole board issue again. When they were passing a resolution, they need to have at least two-thirds majority to pass such a resolution. Therefore, we are deleting 75% and we are replacing with two-thirds. Then we move
from.
Again, that's to put again in that legal basket. And on that audit summary, King Tree was going so far as to say the audit committee is reporting to both
the board.
Shareholders and the board.
Yeah.
And I think when they are dealing with that, they must take into consideration that.
Mm-hmm.
Because according to this understanding that we have been here, they are going to report to the board.
Yeah.
The basket is growing. Okay. Proceed.
Thanks, Chair. Then we move to clause 20. And then on clause 20, we are deleting 21. And we are replacing with a new section, which I think my colleague has spotted the typo there. I think that section will read, the board must, with the approval of the minister, appoint the chief executive officer and appoint a chief financial officer. We need to take out a chief financial officer to ensure that ISMO meets his objectives. I think it's a minor thing. I think we added that. We need to remove. And then.
But also, you say in the bill, meet its objective, but in the A list you say its object. Which is which?
Check. Object. Yeah.
Come
object.
Again?
Object.
Okay.
Yeah.
Proceed.
Okay. Thank you. And then on the same, that the section underneath, which is 22, we are inserting a clause there on 22, which will read as follows. After we've inserted and consider the application received, it will read as follows. The board must invite applications for the post of chief executive officer and chief financial officer by publishing adverts in the media and consider application received. I think that's an issue that we need to include. Consider application received. Then we move to clause 21. On clause 21, which is 21.2, we are deleting and chief financial officer. Yeah, we are deleting chief financial officer, and then if you turn the page to the next page, which is 32, right on top of 32, which is your A, they turn is we're changing R. We are removing R to is. I think that's not on A list. We need to include that. Okay. Same page, page 32. We on number 6. We are deleting the with the concurrency of a minister, the minister acting after consultation with the Minister of Finance. We are deleting that. We are removing the concurrency by the Minister of Energy and the Minister of Finance when determining the remuneration package. And then on page 22, on page 32, sorry, clause 22, again, we are inserting the section after we inserted, we made the insertion, the section will read as, the board must, with the concurrence of the minister, in a case of a chief executive officer and subject to compliance with the Labor Relations Act, terminate employment of the chief executive officer and the chief financial officer. I think that clause is added to make sure that we only subject to the chief executive officer, not the chief financial officer. The way the lawyers say fast this stuff.
Yes, ma'am. Please try to hands because it's a very awkward room, this one.
Okay. Can I take the committee back to page 32?
Wait, let's just finish this one. And if you are hit with it, then you can go back to page 32. Well, it's on page 32, but we have one of the members with 21, which means the termination of employment of the chief executive officer is with the concurrence of the minister. Yes, it is. Okay. Back to you, Suzo.
Okay, Chair. On the issue of remuneration, is page 32, number 6 there, the chief executive officer and chief financial officer are entitled to a remuneration package determined by the board. I know we're deleting the with the concurrence and whatever, but I was just suggesting, aren't we inserting maybe the words something like in line with the remuneration guidelines as determined by the minister, or because there are remuneration guidelines that have to be taken into consideration when board members are being remunerated.
Honorable Mulata.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think personally I would agree to that approach, because remember when we were delivering some of this thing, DP was not there, and we were continuously grappling with what's applicable in other LOEs, and I mean we are not getting sufficient information about that area.
Okay, as I see, we're fine with that. Can you give us the wording? Are you ready with the wording right now?
Not yet, Chair. Can I liaise with the department and seek your advice after this? I just want to couch the wording properly.
Okay, during tea time?
Yes, Chair.
Okay.
Taking back, I think this matter was not adequately resolved. Though I mean, I would say partly resolved. Again, because DPE was not here at that stage, we're not sure what the, and I think it was around the CEO and the CFO, hence we removed the CEO from that arrangement of having a limited term. What's the applicable terms with relation to the SOEs that are under DPE? Because I don't think we managed to have a thorough scope of all the SOEs. Do they have a fixed term? Say is it limited to 8 years, or they can work in perpetuity?
CFOs.
CFOs, and
CEOs. I understand that the CEO appointment is limited to a fixed term. However, the the CFO, or the financial director. He sits on the board as an executive director, so they don't have a fixed term. They are sort of a permanent employee of the SOC. They don't have a fixed term.
Fixed term for CEO, but not for CFO. Thank you. Prof.
The impression, therefore, is that CEO, CFO is a member of the board forever. Is that the understanding?
Yes.
He is a permanent member of the board, but not a permanent, is that the...
As long as he's still an employee. As long as he's still an employee of the board. Okay. No, fine. Let's proceed. I noted things that were flat, and thankfully, man, it's just that I was looking this side, and I saw, actually, I did even write flat. Those are the things that I said to you were outstanding issues that you owe us. You know, that please, as we move along, from time to time, there'll be issues that you find that you did not give a formal response for us so that we resolve on them. You have to move with speed now, because that has a risk of slowing us down. Honorable Mayor.
Yes, I think Honorable Mayor Tula is correct. This is a very critical matter that needs to be resolved. Because if, for instance, if the CEO or CFO is incapacitated due to illness, it's a different case altogether. But if you are still doing a job search and not hired for a CEO of ESCOM, which might take you a longer period, 6 months, and then you run into problems because the law prohibits you as the board from extending the acting period of that acting CEO for more than 6 months, unless you then come up with some exception here in writing. I don't know how it would come back, but certainly would run into problems if the acting period goes beyond 6 months, because you'll be acting outside the law. Because the law we have required you to limit the acting period within 6 months. After 6 months, you are acting outside the law.
So we've made enough emphasis for you to be quite sure at the point, guys.
Thanks, sir. I think we omitted this because I think from our thinking was that we need to propose that we allow the minister to extend that. On request from the board, and the board must request that we make the extension.
That's the point I was saying. The exception must be in writing here. If then you want to say that only after the minister is approved can they extend the project, then it's fine. But if you leave it here, it's restricted to the board.
We would add the clause that allows for an extension of 6 months.
Okay, fine.
Thank you, Chair. On page clause 35. On page 42 on the bill. 41. Clause 42. As 3B. We are omitting end on that B. A. Yeah. N. N. With A. It means to read in an area where there is no electricity connection, apply to a high court for a order, for a court order authorizing entry to the inspection. Then we go to clause 37.
It says the same thing to clause 24. And that's what it says. I'm reading 24, subsection 3. Subsection 3. Which is notwithstanding a litigation or assignment contemplated in subsection 1, the chief executive officer and the chief financial officer, as the case may be, was questioning. You say this and, can you say as the case may be? Why don't you say this one or as the case may be?
What I see being done.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
I thought we're jumping before the party. I'll take you there.
Thanks, Chair. We are on 37. Page 37, we are rejecting that clause. Clause 37, page 43. If I may just give a background to this, it's the whole issue that pertains to we're deleting it. We are sort of inserting a new one. It might look like we deleted the whole thing, but we sort of put it back again. This is the intervention by the minister. If members could recall that during the previous meeting we had was a lengthy debate around it. Therefore, we felt proper that we rewrite that section so that it reflects the discussions members had on the previous meeting. Just to flag some of the issues that were raised, the issue was that why do you have to have both the administrator and the board at the same time? There was a need to make sure that when the minister appoints the administrator, the board should be born by then. When the administrator takes over the entity, it should be under the control of the administrator, not both the board and the administrator. So the new section has been reworded to reflect that. Now, in terms of the new section, I don't know whether I should read it, but please. Okay. I'm reading from 37.1, intervention by the minister. The minister may direct ISMO to take any action specified by the minister if ISMO is in financial difficulty or being mismanaged, fail to perform its function effectively or efficiently, has acted unfairly or in a discriminatory or inequitable way towards a person to whom it owes a duty under this Act, has failed to comply with any law or any policy envisaged in this act. Two, the minister may direct ISMO to take any action specified by minister if ISMO, a directive conflated in subsection 1 must state the reason for issuing the directive, the steps which must be taken to remedy the situation, and reasonable period within which the steps contemplated in paragraph B must be taken. And F3. If ISMO fails to comply with the directive contemplated in subsection 1, within the stated period, the minister may dissolve the board. It means if you fail to comply with what has been mentioned above, then the minister may dissolve the board. After having given ISMO a reasonable opportunity to be heard, and after having afforded ISMO a hearing on any submission received, if the minister dissolves the board, the minister may appoint an administrator to take over the function of the board and do anything which the board might otherwise be empowered or required to do under this act, subject to such condition as the minister may determine. The cost associated with the appointment of the administrator must be borne by ISMO as prescribed by the minister. The minister must review the performance of ISMO regularly whilst it is under administration, and within 3 months of the appointment of the administrator, table a report on his or her findings in the National Assembly. The minister must, as soon as it is feasible, but not later than 6 months, after the dissolution of the board, replace the members of the board in the same manner in which they were appointed. The appointment of the administrator terminates when the board members have been replaced in terms of subsection 5. Notwithstanding this section, the minister retained the right at any time to approach a competent court of law for relief in any matter he or she considers fairness to this act.
I see once again there's only two references. One, you say the minister must review the performance of the office more regularly whilst he's still under administration in ALIS, and then you say in the B under administrations. Just watch out for that.
Yeah.
But proceed anyway.
Thanks, sir. We'll correct it. I think there's a referencing as well that I think was just picked up. I think on 8, subsection 8, I think that would be subsection 5, but we should be subsection 7 now. We would correct that. The referencing.
Yeah, ngifana nama angiz. Are we in the real clean about?
Okay. It's the referencing. If you look at subsection 9 on the section that we are just read now, subsection 8, man, on the section that I just read now, you will see we're saying the appointment of an administrator terminates when the board members have been replaced in terms of subsection 5. We are saying that subsection 5, it should be subsection 7. Yeah.
The cross reference in subsection 8. Madam Lord, if you look at page 11 of the A list, read the appointment of the administrator terminates when the board member has been replaced in terms of subsection 5. It cannot say subsection 5, it should say in terms of subsection 7. Because of the renumbering. I can see you, but yeah, that's what. Sure.
Help me, English is not my first language. So if we say the appointment of the administrator comes to an end when the board members have been replaced in terms of subsection 7,
yeah,
the minister's ministry must not be the member of the board. Oh, nice.
Yes, thank you, Chair.
No, Chair. It's still on that clause as well. 2C. I may refer that probably the period that has been given, reasonable period has been given to, you know, remedy situation. Probably KF can be specified as well. Because you can't say reasonable period. You know?
Honorable, come again, just give us the proper.
On the section 2.
C.
There's 7.2C.
Okay.
We speak about the reasonable period within the steps contemplated in paragraph 2. I mean, paragraph B. The issue around there, it speaks to in terms of the steps that must remedy the situation or the challenge that are within the ISMO. I'm saying, my request last was to say, they mustn't put reasonable period. Instead, they must put a specific time frame to say, probably 3 months. You know, as they've done, I think, on subsection 7, where they specified, say, within 6 months, the minister must appoint the board. In other words, if ever the minister engaged with ISMO, say, ISMO, you've got these challenges, please respond to me. The minister can say respond within reasonable time, but he must give a specific period, say, probably within 3 weeks or within 2 months. So I'm saying that particular assistance.
Okay, before we hand over, and I'm sure the state law advisors and our advisor should be ready as well to make inputs, but honorable reading for now.
Well, I mean, I think the difficulty here is that the reasonable period will depend on precisely what the directive is speaking to. And so I agree with Honorable Rajesh Khadebe about a reasonable period and that she has to specify a time, but I think we can leave it to the discretion of the minister to specify that particular time, just as long as we say reasonable period.
And also DPE, I'm sure you are used to these things. Any comments? Advisor and DPE?
For me, reasonable period is fine, Chair, because, you know, if I don't know, if you prescribe a period, it might be difficult, for example, to if that period elapsed, then what? Then there may be a difficult in terms of fulfilling whatever needs to be fulfilled within that period. So a reasonable period, it's a reasonable period, really open to interpretation here.
Matibela and Honorable Feli.
Chairperson, I don't know. I think with me, I agree with Honorable Khadebe, because when you refer us back to B, the B also just says the steps which must be taken to remedy the situation, and a reasonable period within which the steps contemplated in paragraph B must be taken. But B is just reasonable steps to remedy the situation. It doesn't say. So a person can argue that I wasn't given a time, my time frame is not available. I can continue with what I'm doing. That's how I read it. I don't know, maybe I'm wrong. Thank you, Chair.
Honorable members, what would guide us on this? Isn't it looking at the functions of ISMO? That it would be the failure of ISMO according to its function, which will guide to variety and the numerous. I'm just throwing in my penny thought. Honorable Mlado?
Yeah, I think you're right. For instance, if you look at A, the minister would say, ISMO, for instance, on A, ISMO, I think your financial situation is attention, and I don't agree with you putting more debt on ISMO.
therefore, I request you. Now I'm giving direction to stop what you are doing. That's the. And then, if ISMO is not fulfilling that directive from the minister, the minister says, okay, I'm giving a reasonable period for you to deal with this matter. So it means the board of ISMO must convene to discuss the directive of the minister and indicate to the minister. I assume in this process there will be a lot of exchange between the office of the minister and ISMO to say we have received your directive. And the board is convening in 3 weeks' time or in 2 weeks, depending on the agency of the convening in 2 weeks' time to consider what you had directed us to do after the board meeting. They will write the minister a letter with saying, we have considered your issue. However, we disagree with certain parts of it. We believe, I'm just looking from various angles, we believe we must take this the following step. But when in relation to this one, it has its own complications. So there will be continuous interaction between the minister and the ISMO on whatever is there. For instance, Chairperson, you are right, on B, it will be in relation to the functions. The functions as stated in the Act. Even on C, the unfair discrimination to any party, that ISMO puts a duty under the Act. And if the board, under the extreme circumstances, if the board feels that the minister's directives are reasonable, they can write the minister and say, the time frame is unreasonable, minister, it's not possible for us to be able to resolve that issue within 3 days as you are requiring us, because it's not reasonable. We still have to go and talk to the vendors of ISMO to do certain things. And I assume under those circumstances, the minister can't proceed with the other steps, because if he proceeds with the other steps, that it becomes unfair. It becomes unreasonable. Either it can be challenged in court, even if it's not in challenge in court. When the minister tables her report to Parliament on the work of the administration and everything, I mean, I would assume that a lot of information starts surface, and the Parliament can hold the minister accountable to say your actions in relation to the work of his were unreasonable.
Thank you, Chair. In respect of subsection 2, paragraph C, my view, Chair, is that it is one of those instances where the legislature would not be in a position to fix this period, for the reasons that follow. As we sit here today, we don't know the nature of the challenge that would prompt the minister to issue directives. In other words, we don't know why the minister, we're not sitting with the specific circumstances. Now, absent the specific circumstances, you can't, sitting here today, say for every intervention of the minister must then give these people 6 months or 2 weeks or 3 days. That will have to be determined in respect of each circumstance that requires the intervention of the minister. But what the committee seeks to do by making reference to a reasonable period, let me explain this reasonable period. This paragraph presupposes that the minister has identified certain deficiencies in the performance of the board, and the minister is now giving marching orders to the board to fix the defect, which unfortunately we know there will be defects. But as we sit here today, we don't know what those defects could be and how long those defects would take. That is why then we want to leave that discretion to the minister, who will be dealing with the specifics, because the minister then would know the nature of the challenge she or he is dealing with and how long it would take to fix the problem. But on the other hand, you want the minister to act in a reasonable manner. You don't want the minister to impose unreasonable time frames for the board to fix the identifiable defect. So it is my respectful submission, Chair, that a reasonable period is the most we can do under circumstances. Thank you, sir.
Mongane is convinced. Because finances, as the Honourable Lotta says, can fix it. Maybe needs one meeting, but systems operations, something new, you know, the dispatching, you know, given, a dispatching function given elsewhere, then it starts wobbling, you know, then it needs some little bit of research. Ends up needing more time. So let's leave it at that, Honourable Member. Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I think I was just reading the three is the one that really makes sense. Subsection 3.
Yes.
Yeah. One.
Yeah.
That's the one. I didn't go through that one. That is why
I think Honourable Lord as well. I thought was emphasizing on 3A, which means a reasonable opportunity to be heard. To be heard comes in different ways. A quick, you know, correspondence can go back to the minister. Minister, even at this stage, we sense that the 3 months you have given us won't give us adequate time to fix it. Here are the reasons. The minister reads, gets advice, quickly responds, if you are right, are given extra 2 months, something like that. But the reasonability is the anchor point. Honourable Fairley.
Yeah, thanks, Chair. I mean, I agree with everything that's been said. When trying to draft this legislation, I think of worst-case scenarios as well, and whether this covers that. I mean, I'm just thinking in an instance where the minister, for whatever reason, decides that she wants to now get rid of the board, okay, and pushes that directive out to them, and she puts a time period in there which they can't feasibly actually adhere to, but she does that for the purpose of trying to get rid of the board. Does this reasonable period within this legislation then allow the board to in fact take her to court or him to court if that is the situation? I mean, I'm just wondering if that covers it. Because I just want to avoid a situation where there's suddenly a spat between a minister and a board and suddenly action gets taken and unfair directives get given. Does that then cover that scenario?
That's a different worst case scenario now. I mean, an advocate, because I sense that other instruments come in, because it sounds as an unreasonable act from the minister, but to me there would be other instruments that would come in. But please, yes, advocate,
Chair, that's why we put the term reasonable, so that the minister doesn't act in a subjective manner. Reasonable is if the board were then to take the minister on to say that the time is unreasonable, so that an objective person can say, look, we are agreed that these times were not reasonable. But in short, yes, it's possible for the board to challenge in court the directive of the minister as unreasonable.
Thank you, Chair. If I may add, also the test of reasonableness has been long standing in court and it's been tried and tested many times, so the committee can relax, we are covered in the report.
Okay, now the fine, then let's move. Won't go back.
Thank you, Chair. We are on clause 38, which is...
Sorry, you wanted something before, Won't go back.
To give the committee a comfort in terms of the board members being allowed an opportunity. In terms of, I'm just looking at the Companies Act here, the removal of directors. In terms of the Companies Act, the directors must be given, it's a mandatory provision that says a director must be afforded a reasonable opportunity to make a presentation in person or through a representative to the meeting before any resolution is taken to remove him. So I think it also goes back to the discussion that we had with Honorable Mulota last week as to are they entitled really to be given an opportunity to be removed. That's number one. Secondly, I just wanted to suggest that maybe where we're talking about replacing members, can we use a language that is in line with the Companies Act to say that we rotate or we remove, not replace.
Hoping, Gwyneth, where is that now?
Oh, Okay, I'm looking at page 46, 7, yeah, floor 7. Yeah, we took remove the members or rotate the members. That's the language that is used in the company section.
Just language consistency. Okay, fine. Oh, I'm ready.
Chair, I just feel the need to bring it up, but I might be wrong here at all. It's just the on the clause 4, if the minister dissolves the board, the minister may appoint an administrator to take over the functions of the board. I'm just wondering, they may. I mean, we could have a situation there where the minister decides not to appoint an administrator, and so we don't have a board and we don't have an administrator. Do we want to change the name to a master, or is it feasible to have a situation where we don't appoint an administrator and there's no board? I just felt the need to bring it up. I don't know. Maybe.
For A. Would minister dissolve and then. Thanks for that. But it would be the most bizarre situation. You remove the board, don't appoint an administrator. Then it's a state of limbo.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, Advocate Banas.
Chair, on the clause that we were busy with, I see here, for instance, in your 3A and B, there's opportunity offered to board members. In A, the board may be dissolved, A, after having given the board a reasonable opportunity to be heard. One. And B, after having afforded the board a hearing on any submissions received. I don't know the difference between A and B. Because it seems as if we're giving the board now too many opportunities to be heard.
Yeah.
Guys, department, what do you have in mind?
Yeah, I don't know whether our advisor would like to say something here. But I think when you look at it, the first one is sort of talks about to be heard. It means it could be verbally or otherwise. And the second one, it talks about submission. It means people might have, put something in writing to say this is what we think and these are the issues. And then you need them to take those submissions into account and consider them properly. I suppose that was the thinking.
You mind if we just had to listen to Advocate Nyigis at first, Honourable Lord? Samir?
Okay. Thank you, Chair. Shall I agree with Advocate Vanarelia, because to be heard is broad enough. It covers all scenarios, whether it's submission, whether it's oral, it's everything. So I would suggest that we delete B and we only stay with one paragraph, which is A, which is broad enough.
I did pick that up. I assume that it referred to submissions from other people submitting to the minister about problems or challenges. But if what I'm raising, Advocate Vanara, is catered for elsewhere, then okay. What if someone complains to the minister and then the board then has to respond to that submission? Not by the board now. I'm not thinking fast. I'm not provoking something. Yes, one of them not well.
Yeah, but Chairperson, even if it's a submission from somebody else, A will still be relevant in the sense that the minister would still give ISMO a reasonable opportunity to be heard on that submission from a different person. Yeah.
Yes, Mklo.
With the greatest of respect, Chair, I don't see any place for play, because an opportunity to be heard is an opportunity to be heard, irrespective of form, it remains the same.
Point taken.
But again, Chair, if I will take you back to, I think it's 1C, my understanding was that C, the committee took a conscious decision to delete C.
1 1 C.
One C, yes, I see, but then it was linked to something in clause 38, wasn't it? Was it the one that? No. Okay, Honorable Lord.
Chairperson, I think Advocate Banara is right. I was tempted to say it, but I thought maybe I missed something. I think in our deliberations we recommend the deletion of C, because Chairperson, the C that you are referring to is a different C, under 38. That was 37(4)C, not 37(1)C.
Oh,
yeah.
But I did pick this up because I had written that to be omitted.
Yeah.
But when there were a lot of changes, I thought that was also affected. Okay. Department, are you reinstating that?
37(1)C.
Are you reinstating 37(1)C? Why are you proposing? Because the bill is on our hands. Eh?
The type of thing.
Okay. Thanks for that, Advocate Banara. Yes, Mukro.
Chair, once again, still on page 17 of the bill as introduced. Paragraph 17, that is line 45, from line 44 actually. Page 17 of the original bill, the bill as introduced. That paragraph reads, subsection 7, A says, notwithstanding subsection 3, the minister may dissolve the board if the minister, comma, on good cause shown, comma, loses confidence in the ability of the board to perform its functions effectively and efficiently. Now, this was, in my reading, a second ground for the dissolution of the board. Now, in terms of the proposed amendment in the A list, it does not take into account that ground for the dissolution of the board.
What ground?
The loss of confidence on good cause shown.
Loss of confidence on good cause shown. Department, have you articulated that somewhere? If you feel that has been obtained somewhere, let them show us that. But Honorable Lord,
just before the department comes in, and I would want to refer to Advocate Banara to 37(1)(1)B, and looking at it, if you put it against 7A, the minister may dissolve the board if the minister on good cause shown loses confidence in the ability of the board, the inability of the board to perform its functions effectively and efficiently. Wouldn't it be covered by B? Because here it says B says fails to perform its functions effectively or efficiently. Wouldn't it be the same? I'm just asking.
That's that energy snack. I wouldn't say all of us just run through the restructured clause and look at whether that has been catered for or where it can be catered for. Good was shown on one side and also loss of confidence. I think those are the two anchor points that Advocate Banara is wants to ensure that they are included. Yes, sir.
I'm just trying to amplify my point. My point is that I think, personally, I think 7A, I mean, 7(1)B, it's almost the same as section 7A. Because here you're saying the leader has lost confidence in the ability of the board to perform its functions effectively and efficiently.
Okay.
And 7(1)(1)B says the minister may direct ISMO to take actions specified by the minister if ISMO B fails to perform its functions effectively or efficiently. And therefore, if it affects that that aspect, then the minister can, after giving them, after they have received the directive, unless you are, the argument then says, once the minister just lost the confidence that this of this mode of perform functions, it doesn't have, she does, she or he doesn't have to issue a directive to ISMO, can then proceed to dissolve ISMO. Because in the first instance of the 7.1b, the minister will have to issue a directive to ISMO to take certain steps to remedy the situation. But then, in the, and if they fail to take these steps, the minister can dissolve the board. But the, in the instance that Advocate Vanara is talking about, here the minister doesn't have to issue any directive to the ISMO. She just, she or he, straight away just proceed to dissolve the board on the basis that the board can't function effectively and efficiently. I think, yeah, I mean, I'm getting that distinction. I just want to understand, yeah, why it's been, I couldn't follow you.
Also that point as well, Honorable Mlotu, that one's about giving a directive, the other one is actually about dissolution.
Chair, from my side, I think Honorable Lord has got the two correct. It is a policy decision what you want to do with it, really. Do you just want the minister, if the board does not perform efficiently and effectively, to be given a directive, or simply to be just afforded an opportunity, I mean, to be dissolved, or first we afforded that opportunity to. But in any event, it will still be given. In both instances, it will have to be afforded an opportunity to address the minister. So it's really a policy decision for the committee to decide.
The department is not a respondent.
Chair, you are putting me in an awkward position.
I have to.
After the lawyers have said the policy decision.
because of that. apologies. But I thought you wanted a splendid piece of legislation that would enable the department to work efficiently, so you would even take the opportunity to put in some things before we even come to a policy conclusion. It's not that you would not take a policy conclusion, but it's an opportunity for you to influence that. You see? Okay, go.
Policy-wise, just accept that the directive has to be there. And they should just marry the two. I like that lack of confidence. They must just marry the two and let it be.
Because, remember, it was three stages. It was saying, is a directive, because minister, you have observed certain deficiencies. Then suspend, and then dissolve. We said, no, it can't be three stages. Let it just be two. The first one, the minister identifies certain challenges and issues a directive. Then the second stage is that once the minister feels that things are not working, the ISMO board is still failing, you then dissolve. Now what Advocate Vanara is saying then, I think it's actually in the second stage, that is dissolution, is that what was articulated in the original bill was the good, lots of consequence and good cause shown. And what I'm reading from him, he says he doesn't really pick that up in the restructured clause now. Whereas in the under directive, yes, there is some ground. Am I reading you correctly? Yes, Mran.
Chairperson, I think it was omitted in the bigger in the this other document. Now, I like thinking about scenarios before I agree to something. Let's put it this way. It's an unfortunate example that I have to put across. The board, okay, on issues of finance, you know, I'm talking about a financial difficulty. You say to the board, no. I don't want you to go and take loans. I don't want you to take those excessive loans. or the way the finance, I'm not specifically on finance, you can pinpoint it and ask the board to remedy that situation. Now, on we have omitted C. Let's go to D, easier one. There's NEMA, there's on environmental issues, you believe the board is not taking the issue of NEMA into consideration. You say to board, can you address those issues? I'm understanding that there's a serious violation of the environmental laws in terms of your activity. Can you cease from doing that or rehabilitate that area and give it back to the community because you have destroyed that area? But you can, those are specific incidents. But now you have this unfortunate situation where you have got paralysis of the SABC board. You know, that's the unfortunate situation I have to put across. You have a paradox of an SEC, but you can't say that one must have to, you can't let the directive as a minister. As the chairman, can you ensure that you work well with your board members? That directive for me doesn't have any impact. Because you can't force human dynamics, human relationships. You can't force them. In a direction, let's say, the three of you must work that four, and that one must cooperate. You can't force those main relations. But if you feel it has reached this stage of an SABC board, what do you do? Because there's no directive that will relate to that situation. So hence the point that has been raised by Advocate Banana. You might want to retain that original seven and say, this thing has reached a point of paralysis, I appreciate it, and we have assessed it, this board can't just function. On its own, the board doesn't gel, it's not going to work. Let me solve it. I think Advocate Banana is writing that.
Thank you, sir. However, then, moving forward, if we put the clause back, but not limit it to functioning or efficiently, but it has to be to good cause, so the minister loses confidence, we end so that it goes over and above what is listed in subsection 1.
But can I draw your attention as well to in the new bill 46 at the top under C, say if he small fails to comply with the directive contemplated in subsection 1 within the stated period, the minister may dissolve the board. There's also Advocate Banara, you feel that's not enough.
I think, Honourable Chair, Honourable Muloto articulated the position very well. There will be instances where a directive might not be desirable. You might, by issuing a directive, be suspending the inevitable, that of dissolving the board. And if then that is the situation, the directive would not help. Because the section itself still refers to a directive. That would not be sufficient. I think it is a situation...
It's a scenario whereby the minister would be expected to immediately dissolve the board. Okay.
It's trying to cover for an over and above situation which is going to encompass any scenario which may arise. So therefore we can empower the minister to dissolve the board on good cause shown if the minister loses confidence on the board.
Without having issued a directive first. One of the members are together, ne?
Yes.
This is what is arising. Without issuing a directive first. But it must be on good cause shown. Honorable Khaling is still not clear. Why don't you let the advisors craft it and then they bring it back? Is that fine? Going, gone. Oh, just on that point, have we cracked our scars enough? Can you take a break? Tea might be getting cold outside.
I know. Four, if
if the minister dissolved the board, the minister must, we are removing May, the minister must appoint the administrator to take over the functions of the board and to do anything which the board might otherwise been empowered or required to do under this act, subject to such condition as the minister may determine. Five, the cost associated with the appointment of the administrator must be borne by ISMO, as prescribed by the minister. The minister must review the performance of ISMO regularly whilst it is under administration, and within 3 months of the appointment of the administrator, pull the report of his or her finding in the National Assembly. The minister must, as soon as it's feasible, but not later than 6 months after dissolving the board, we are changing replace by either remove, we're going to put remove or rotate. The lawyers would have to look at that, so that we align it with the Companies Act. The minister must, after, as soon as it is feasible, but not later than 6 months after dissolution of the board, remove the members of the board in the same manner in which they were appointed, or repeat the members. I think it's supposed
to. Can you start again?
I was trying to read the new thing that we supposed to insert there. We're saying we're gonna change the base with and put remove there. Or rotate. I think that was my understanding. So if you change replace, we put remove, then it will read as follows. Okay. The minister, as soon as it is feasible, but not later than 6 months after the dissolution of the board, remove the members of the board in the same manner in which they were appointed. Yeah, it doesn't read right.
Just be homework.
Yeah, let's have a look at that last part. But if you're saying remove the members of the board, I don't understand why we're saying as in the manner in which they were appointed. I don't know. We just need to look at that. Okay. And then we're saying on clause 8, we're going to replace that 7, that 5, that subsection 5, with 7, which means it's going to read as, the appointment of the administrator terminates when the board members have been replaced, which means we're going to change that to replace in terms of subsection 7. Okay? Then the only thing that's not here is clause 7 on the bill, which we need to bring it into this. Clause 7 on your old bill, the one with numbering, which we need to bring it in back to this clause.
Yes, yes, one is aware of that homework as well. Proceed.
Thank you, Chair. Done with that section, then we move to clause 38. On clause 38, 1B, we are substituting that section with a new B. You will notice that on what we are substituting, we are saying substitution, but in principle, we are deleting the last part of that sentence. Okay? It's not necessarily substitution. Let me read how it's going to read right now. 38.1B, is what it says, a person commits an offense if he or she, B, fails to give data or information or gives false or misleading data or information when required to do so in terms of section 36. That's the new section. Then we are also omitting section C, which is 31C.
31?
No, 38.1C, sorry. 38:1.
Yeah. On the same section, the one that was I'm confused because I think last time we said we are taking off the last part, which says the space has also been covered. After the first and the beating, we said we must put it back. It says we are taking it out again. So I'm not sure where we are. But we're saying even the administrator has been covered, so that when he does these things, the penalty comes in.
And inputs. I forget another.
No, Chair, the Prof. Mayatula is correct. The committee would recall at its last meeting we had extensive discussions around this particular provision. Remember, this is the provision that would enable the administrator upon his or her appointment to conduct successful investigations, so that he or she is not hindered or obstructed by officials that are withholding information, so that in the event that such withholding of information occurs, that the administrator could then rely on this provision to institute criminal proceedings or lay charges against those obstructing him or her in the course of his or her duties. And the committee was very clear that it wanted this provision to be retained and not to be deleted.
Thanks, sir. I think it, I can see it on my notes here. I think it's an omission, sir.
I suppose we should be doing things over the weekend. That's where the problem is. Advocate Nyigizo.
Thank you, sir. In the light of the new clause 7, and if we retain it, we're going to have to redraft because there's no longer a directive by the administrator in terms of cross-referencing and everything. So we have to come up with new wording now because it's not going to make sense because the administrator given broad powers in terms of this act. There's no longer specifics like we had in the earlier 37 where there was step-by-step provision. Otherwise, it's going to be referring to something which is broad, where power that is broad.
7-4-C or whatever. Fine. It's good if you've drawn that attention to us. It's on record. If you could then do the requisite restructuring.
Okay. Thanks, sir. We would redraft that. We are on clause 39. On clause 39, on 31, Chair. 39, 1, 2.
I think so, Honorable Padre.
By the caucus on the other night.
Is there a caucus? Is there another meeting that side? Okay, Korea.
Thanks, sir. We are on page 48 on the bill, which is 39-2. On 39-2, we are removing and its subsidiaries. I think this deletion is aligned with the division of the section. I think it's section 6 where it talks about subsidiaries. And then on the same page, 39.3, we are deleting the whole of 39.3 and we sort of substitute that with a new section. The new section in 39.3 was, it basically, if I can, before I read it, just to give context to it, it's members will remember that we sort of proposed to include a section that deals with consultation when developing regulations. And this is the section that we sort of had here. And the consultation was with the members of the public and also tabling of these regulations to Parliament. Now the section will read as follows, with those comments in mind. When making or amending regulation contemplated in terms of Section 1, a minister must invite public comments and duly consider comments prior to finalization of the regulation and table the regulations in Parliament for publishing the final version of in the Gazette. Then 4, the minister may make regulations to ensure effective implementation of this Act, including regulations relating to. The change is there, as you may note, is the, if I go back a little bit, is the inclusion of A, which invite public comment and reconsider comments prior to finalization of the regulation, and then and also B, tabling of the regulations in part before publishing the final version in the Gazette. Then if we go to page 49, the regulations are sort of listed in page 49. Those are the regulations that the minister could, you know, develop. Just to try and go through them quickly. A, the minister may develop regulations that relate to A, criteria to be used by the minister in determining customers to whom ISMO may sell electricity, to whom ISMO must sell electricity, or may purchase electricity directly from generators, including technical criteria, financial criteria, criteria for normal, for national importance, or from security, from a security perspective. B, the transfer of customers and related rights and obligations from ESCOM or other suppliers to ISMO, including compulsory transfer of customers, contract, handling of existing long-term contract, the splitting of contract between energy and wheeling, and the matters associated therewith. The transfer of other rights and obligations and staff, excluding transmission. This was a comment that was raised at a meeting that we need to be explicit in terms of excluding transmission. Transfer of functions, including the timeline within which ISMO must assume the execution thereof, and any other regulation necessary or ancillaries to the above to facilitate the smooth implementation of ISMO. So those are the regulations that would be made by the minister under this Act. Then on
can I just get clarity on this page 13 in the A list at B. If you start counting from the line in B, 1, 2, 3, the fourth line starting with contracts. I just want to have clarity on this. When you say the splitting of contracts between energy and wheeling, does that sound? It's not sounding clear to me. Energy and wheeling. Wheeling is, doesn't wheeling also refer to wheeling of energy? So you see energy and wheeling. Or maybe the converse of my question, weren't you referring to something else when you said energy?
Okay, thanks, sir. I think it's a splitting of energy and wheeling. Wheeling is a is the manner in which you transport the energy. What that section means is that we want to split the wheeling of power from the cost of wheeling from the cost of power. So that when you as a transmitter you charge for the wheeling but not necessarily for the power, then somebody else charges for the power. At the moment you will find that the contracts that include both they don't necessarily differentiate from a willing perspective. They sort of say the energy will be 125 per kilowatt hour at the meter at your gate or at your house. But you don't necessarily have the separations on that 125, how much is energy and how much is willing cost. So that's what that section says, that as we transfer these functions, we need to be mindful of the fact that now some of those contracts, if we move these customers to ISMO, we need to provide for that in one way or the other, in terms of now the willing cost will remain with ESCOM, but the energy cost will be with ISMO for specific customers, but not all of them, but for those that are actually all those customers that will be selling to ISMO, because ISMO will not have any infrastructure to deliver the power. You need to have that split in terms of wheeling and energy charge. In principle, what would happen is that a customer would receive a wheeling bill, which means it's your infrastructure cost, and then ISMO will then issue with the energy cost, separate the two.
Yeah, so I
want
to say something about
Melbourne Investment. Yeah. Surely it's the other way around, as far as I would understand, that the wheeling cost is Melbourne charge. So essentially you've got a situation where you've got an IPP on one hand, selling to a company on the other hand, and using the grid to wheel it through. So surely ISMO would then charge the wheeling cost to wheel that energy through, but those two companies would then contract in terms of paying the energy from the IPP paid by the company that received it. I was just
See, on the other hand, you're explaining it, you understand.
Mm-hmm.
But if you read it as it is there, is that phrase as it is captured, my dear legal advisor as well, Does it capture what has been explained? And I trust and hope somewhere willing is also explained. May not be this act or whatever, because once new terms come in, you know, in a bill of such significance, it's important that we are assured of their common explanation and common understanding as well. Yes, sir.
Thanks, sir. We can try and simplify it, sir. But just to try and respond to Honorable Hiram's questions, there are two parts to it. You've got the supply side, you've got the demand side. The demand side being your consumers, people who sort of use the energy. On the supply side, it will be your IPPs, those who generate on your ESCOM generators. You probably need different arrangements between two. Okay, the arrangement might not be exactly the same, but the principle is similar in terms of how you split the cost. The pricing policy, it says something around the supply side and how you treat cost related to transmission. Okay, it sort of says there should be at least 50%, 50-50 sort of contribution towards transmission cost, which means as a supplier, as an IPP or as a generator, you should contribute towards the cost of building the infrastructure, okay, relative to where the load is. If you are far away from the load, you should know that you will contribute a bit higher compared to a person who's closer to the load. So there is that principle in the pricing policy that is already entrenched. But the issue here is that the infrastructure, which is your lines, will not be owned by ISMO. It will be owned by somebody else at this point. So that person would charge a price for wheeling the power. And that person who is owning that infrastructure at this point, which will be Eskom, will not be involved in the PPA, in the sales of the energy. Will only be interested in the use of the network. And then that person then will then determine the price per kilowatt hour of using that network. Obviously, it will have to be regulated by the regulator. And a similar principle also applies on the supply side. However, on the supply side, it's a bit limited because the transmission lines will go all the way up to distribution. In the household level, you will not see that. It's only your distributor that will pick up those differences, but at the lower level, you will not be in a position to see that. However, big customers that will be purchasing directly from this would, you know, in some way be in a position to see those differences.
Okay, but a little bit, even if you can play around and see if there could be a different wording of that phrase, so that we could compare down the line. Yeah.
We would certainly look at that. Thanks.
Kali?
Thanks, sir. We are on clause 40. Clause 41A, we are omitting on the effective date, which means your clause 41A will read as follows: Eskom must, and within the time period determined by the minister by a notice in the gazette. Then we move on the same section, clause 41, Roman 41, Roman figure 1. 41A, Roman figure 1. I don't understand.
That's for my understanding. We are referring here to Eskom 40.
Yes.
I know on page 20 of the bill itself, it did read and said Eskom. Holding. When is Eskom
holding? Okay, Ibamba, Prof. I'm told by Fumen if that can be sorted out consistently. Oh, sorry, consistency, please. Consistency.
We apologize about that. I think it's because even this version is probably a version that the city of just pulled out and dusted it. To try it. I think it will depend on how we define it. I think the right way is to look at how we define Eskom and then use that way throughout.
You said Eskom holding.
I think the definition we said Eskom holding. Therefore, that's the right way to do it. Thanks for raising that so that we be consistent in what we do. Thank you. Then on page 50 on the bill, right on top the first sentence, we have sort of bold and bracket out, then we insert it in so that it reads as set in terms of this act. I know that the initial input from Prof there was that we should insert in, but it says as set in terms of this act. I don't know if it's
My suggestion here was, to me it sounds better to say as set out in. So I started adding in. I didn't take out the out. Why are we taking out the out?
That's why I'm raising it, because I know that you...
Okay, it reads the performance functions as set out in terms of this act. Thank you. Of course, they've said it in the A-list properly, say on page 19 in line 2. After out to insert in.
Okay. Right. Yeah, I think it's that's why when I was reading it here, I could see that it's not the way
it was said.
Yeah.
But would correct it. Thank you, sir. Okay, and then we move to page 51, which will be your clause 2. That clause, say, I think it was that secular reference that we sort of, it was raised by Prof in terms of the organs of state. Can I request that we sort of, because we just had a discussion now, it's just that we never had time to engage on some of these things living among ourselves. Can I suggest that we take this one back? Because the deletion of the whole of that section, we need to make sure that it's catered for somewhere else, and we need to make sure that the referencing to those other legislations that we were sort of referencing to here, it's still, you know, maintained in one way or the other, so that we don't lose something by deleting it. So my plea is that if you could give us some time to have a look at it again and see whether it's not there any other way we could deal with the state-owned entity or organ of state without having to delete the whole section.
Fine.
Thank you, Chair. And then we move to 52, page 52 on the bill. Yeah, 52, subsection 9. We are deleting that all the way up to E, from A up to E. This is in line with the discussion that members had with regards to the reference to the Labor Relations Act. There was a view that there's no need to try and repeat what the Labor Relations Act provides for. We rather refer to, you know, the Labor Relations Act with regards to transfer of employees. So what we've done, we've taken up the whole of that session, and then we left, we just rewrote the session, and to be brief and precise, in terms of referring back to the Labor Relations Act. It means your section nine, subsection 9 will read, when an employee of Eskom Holding becomes an employee of ISMO in terms of subsection 5 and 7, the Labor Relations Act of 1995, Act number 466 of 1995 applies. So I check that. That subsection, we will check that, Chair. I just want to check that subsection 5 and 7. But we'll check that cross-reference. My colleague will have a look whether it's right, given that we have deleted some of the things. Thanks, Chair. Then we move to 41. On 41, subsection 1, we are deleting subsection 1 and subsection 2. Having deleted that, we are sort of inserting a new 1 and a new 2, which will read as follows. From the effective date, ISMO is responsible for the function listed in section 4, provided that the execution thereof by ISMO may be assumed in a phased manner as determined by the minister by notice in the Gazette.
You're still retaining N.
In a phased manner.
Yeah.
then we are aiding there in a phased manner, as defined by the minister by notice in the Gazette. If you look at one, didn't have that section, that part of the sentence, we're adding that. Then on two, ISMO must enter into contractual arrangement with ESCOM for the execution of such of its funding contemplated in subsection 4, as parties may agree upon. We're adding the as parties may agree upon. Through you, Chair, we move to 41.4. We are deleting 41.4 and substituting it with a new section. The new section reads as follows. The Minister may, in consultation with Cabinet, determine by notice in the Gazette the date for the transferring of the functions to ISMO referred to in subsection 2. What we have added there, we have added ISMO referred to. To ISMO referred to in subsection 2. We added ISMO there in that paragraph. Because if you look at the first one, it didn't have that.
Read it again.
It's going to read as follows. The Minister may, in consultation with Cabinet, determine the notice in the Gazette, the date for transferring of the functions to ISMO referred to in subsection 2. Okay, yeah, which is your contractual arrangement.
How would it be if you put in else after ISMO? I mean, some A determined by notice in the Gazette the date for transfer of the function to ISMO as referred to in subsection 2. I'm cautious, English is not my. Put on.
Thanks, I will add that.
That's good for another person.
So, Chair, I think what we wanted to say, or want to say, is the Minister may, in consultation with Cabinet, determine by notice in the Gazette the date for transferring the functions. I don't think the off there is correct. The off should come off. You're transferring the functions. Which functions are referred to in subsection 2? And those functions you want to transfer to ISMO. So I think the to ISMO should come at the end there. Because you're transferring the functions that are referred to in subsection 2 to ISMO.
Honourable members, how do you feel? I mean, look, that was exactly my attempt, just to make the whole thing quite a little clearer, you know, because it's only when you explain that you pick up what that means. If you are happy, let's not agree and then move. Tell me you're done. You didn't even realize you're done. Honorable Mlodo.
Just a quick one. On page 53, it should be subsection 9, the last one. When an employee of ESCOM becomes an employee of ISMO, sorry I missed it when I went to the bathroom, in terms of subsection 5 or 7, shouldn't it be preceded by a section? There are two main subsection 5 or 7 in that Labor Relations Act. I'm not sure whether you corrected that. Of which section? Oh, okay. So now I see what you mean.
Of subsection
5 or 7 here in the bill,
then the LRA applies.
It's just some it's the word construction, it's standard construction.
I forget, Vanna.
Oh, sorry, Prof. Booth of Utabella of Land.
I forget, Vanna.
Chair, again, the discussions around this particular subsession are related to what happens to the employees that are currently with ESCOM and want to come east. And how then do you make that regime that transfer not to be to their detriment? And there was a specific reference to a section 197 of the Labor Relations Act that specifically deals with the transfer of employees in these instances. Now, I don't understand why we've been referred to the Labor Relations Act and not specifically to section 197.
Professor Pitu Janadi, if you could just back to the department.
Thanks, sir. I think the thinking was that we are referring to the Labor Relations Act, of which Section 197 is part of the Labor Relations Act. But I think, in our view, there's no harm in referring to that 197, you know, specifically. But I think that does not necessarily mean it's only 197 that would apply, you know. I think we're trying to be cautious not to single out one section as if that's the only section that should be applicable, but we can make that reference.
Other
words,
Banara?
No, Chair, I think we need to make specific reference to 197 of the Labor Relations Act. When you write legislation, you must write it with legal certainty. This provision, if we make specific reference to 197 of the Labor Relations Act, anybody who interprets this section would know that this or Parliament had in mind exactly the provision of section 197 of the Labor Relations Act when it enacted this provision. And there would be no issues around this, because I've seen odd cases where the court now must determine whether these circumstances are what 197 should be applicable to or not. Now, to avoid that, we want to make it clear what Parliament had in mind is that 197 should be applicable in this instance. Thank you, sir.
Okay, fine. We'll address that. Okay, back to you, Professor.
Thank you, sir. I'm taking you back to a clause that is not referred to in the A list. It is clause 31. In this big document on page 8, in this big document is page 38, page 8, subsection 3. Are we together? Page 1, 3. It says, if or may not. ISMA may not dispose of the majority of its assets or such part of its assets as to have a significant impact on the ability to perform its functions without the prior approval of the Minister of Finance. I was imagining a situation when there has been tea of any calf, the Minister of Finance tells the Minister of Energy that I was approached by the board about these assets. My question was, why is it that we have not included the energy minister there? Can the board go directly to finance minister and they discuss issues of energy without the Minister of Energy, you know?
Yeah.
In fact, did we raise that sometime? We said reference to the Minister of Finance should link that up with the saying the Minister of Energy should be part of the platform. TP would like to make an input first.
Prof is right. If you look at the PFMA in terms of section 54 that talks about the asset disposal by state-owned company, the approval actually got to be by the executive authority in consultation with the Minister of Finance. That's how it reads section 54.2 of PFMA.
Okay. So the executive authority approves, but however, the Minister of Finance or Petty Squam has to play a role. So that's how it should be articulated, not only in what Prof has raised, but in others as well. I see in fact, 31D put it nicely, Minister after consultation with the Minister of Finance. Can you look at 31 as a whole? In that context, Honorable Mulato.
Thank you, Chairperson. I don't know whether it's correct, but maybe what we need to say on 31.3 is to say ISMO may not dispose of the majority of its asset or such part of its asset as would have a significant effect on that. We need to perform this budget without the approval of prior approval of the Minister of Energy and the Minister of Finance. Because here, I mean, the person who should have the financial on this matter will be the Minister of Finance. The way I understood the interest relating to section 5, section 54, that it should be done in consultation with the Minister of Finance. In consultation meaning there must be an agreement. Without the agreement of the Minister of Finance, you can't proceed to do what you wanted to do. But 331 subsection 1D, such other ones and assets as may be approved by the Minister, that one is at least caters for the Minister of Energy. C, shareholder contributions approved by the, I don't know whether we need to insert the Minister of Energy, also the, yeah, but I think page 1-3 definitely can insert the Minister of Energy.
That's what I was saying. Maybe to restructure my input is that section 31 is about management of funds and assets, isn't it? Isn't there any legal or any guidance elsewhere that can assure us of how this should be done? Can I ask it in that way, DP? Because it's a daily bread. I take it as you are articulating the management of funds and assets as in section 31. Withdraw reference from other laws and policies and other instruments as well. I'm triggered by Roger saying you spoke of an executive authority, which means somewhere, somehow, in terms of state-owned entities generally or state-owned companies specifically, the executive authority is guided on how it should play a role here. But at the same time, because it's about management of funds and assets, the Minister of Finance has got to be factored in somewhere, somehow. I'm just rambling it generally. You know, and Honorable Lotto has actually raised this specifically at the same time. So I'd like you people to take that on board as well, because I know it's, am I overlooking what you said? Yes, Honorable Mulato.
Chairperson, if we, I'm not a drafter, but I just want to attempt something. 31 C, 31 subsection 1 C, if it says shareholder contributions approved by the Minister of Energy, well, by the Minister, in consultation with the Minister of Finance, it might not be the right English, but there's something along those lines.
Member Atibet.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, is the minister not covered here by shareholder? Because the minister is a shareholder of this. It's not like that. Or am I wrong?
In fact, you are reminding me, I did ask that as well. What exactly do they mean by shareholder contributions here? Now, thanks for reminding me. Because shareholder contributions could mean a lot of things. Can you respond to this thing now, or do you need some space?
Thanks, sir. We can have a look at it certainly and talk to our colleague as well. I think if we look at that section 31C, it talks about the shareholder. I think in this case, Mama Tiba is right. I think the shareholder is our minister. What that section tries to say is that our minister, in making a contribution to ISMO, she must get approval of the Minister of Finance. I think that's what that section is trying to say. But I'm not sure whether we're supposed to be saying it or we shouldn't say it, but I think the section says those contributions need to be authorized.
The fund and assets of ISMO consist of shareholder contributions approved by the Minister of Finance. So shareholder contributions, as the shareholder has been defined in the Act, would then mean contributions by, okay, as foreseen, fine. And then we're saying in 31.3 we need to add the role of the Minister of Energy as the executive authority. Okay? There's no other area. You find Prof then? Yeah. And please, let me remind, once again, we did say so. I'm glad that DD has actually been very helpful, that come with the term executive authority. Where references need to other ministers, we should factor in what role has to be played by the specific executive authority here, which is the Minister of Energy. If should there be any other area that would warrant that. Prof, you're fine now with 31. Okay, thank you. If I remember, some people had to do some homework during tea time. Am I not right, Mr. Kota? Yeah. Who was supposed to do homework during tea time? Or did you just enjoy the cookies? No. Never forget. What was it? Oh, the committee? Did they do the homework? No, they didn't. And please don't do the homework during weekend. At least they've got a couple of days in between. Other members, if by reminding them of the homework, is any other thing?
Chair, as far as the audit committee members are concerned, we did check with the Companies Act. Section 94 talks about appointment of audit committees by the board, whereas Section 61 talks about the shareholders meeting, which is the annual general meeting. So at each annual general meeting, audit committee is appointed. It is appointed. However, it does not, the fact that it is dealt with at the annual general meeting does not detract from the fact that, although it's a shareholders meeting, which is the annual general meeting, it does not detract from the fact that it is appointed by the board. What I'm trying to say here is that it is the board that appoints the shareholder, that appoints the audit committee members. That was
the only difference, that it's appointed at
At the shareholders meeting.
I think that's where the shareholder factor comes in, because the shareholder is present at an AGM. It's addressed members, isn't that fine?
Second teacher, if I may come in, I think another homework was also asked to give some wording around the remuneration. I think if you look at page 32, where it talks about the chief executive officer and financial officer are entitled to remuneration.
Okay.
Page 32?
Yes.
I don't know what line is it, but
it's
under
subsection
6. Yes.
Page 21 on the members, page 32 in the bill, and page 8 in the...
Yeah. The wording that we're proposing here, noting that we're dealing with the concurrence of the minister, we're saying that the chief executive officer and the chief financial officer are entitled to a remuneration package determined by the board in line with the remuneration guidelines for state-owned companies as approved by cabinet.
Again?
In line with the remuneration guidelines for state-owned companies as approved by cabinet. The reason why we said as approved by cabinet, the change that currently, I'll just make an example of what is happening at DPE. DPE, we've got our own remuneration guidelines that we're using to remunerate members of the board. But we're taking into consideration that there is a PRC, Presidential Review Committee, that is busy with the remuneration guidelines. And as soon as it is finalized, it will be approved by cabinet, I think, for all state-owned companies.
I think that's fine. We did comment at that stage about the fact that how we should have had that presidential review work done to guide us here. But I think the way it's factored in, I don't know how to feel members, is that okay? It seems it's fine. Yes,
Honorable Rat. Yes, I don't want to take you back, but maybe as you are moving towards finalization of the bill, it would be important for the department and public enterprise just to double check with the Institute of Directors what's the practice around the appointment of the external auditor and the audit committee, just not to be sure about some of these things, because I was checking the King 3 where it keep on insisting on that shareholders must do the following, but I think let's verify that.
Okay, I'm sure they've taken note of that. Other members, I think we need to allow the legal advisors now to get the department to go and clean up issues that we have added and changed and refined today, and we then stand adjourned until Tuesday next week. Thank you very much.